Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 44 of Season 7 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1995 Bruce Willis action film Die Hard with a Vengeance, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Niall McGowan of the Bat Minute. Welcome back to the show, Niall.
Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure to be here, Rob. Thank you. Thank you for having me for... It's been, one of the biggest minutes of the movie, really, right? Like, this has been, not only
one of the biggest minutes
of this movie, it also contains a little snippet of one of the biggest minutes of one of the previous films as well. So,
that is correct.
Getting the twofer right here.
Very true, very true. So the minute 44 begins with a man who we've now identified as the FBI director, asking John a question, and ends with Andrew saying hello.
So not just any FBI chief, of course, FBI chief Hugh Prantera. Of course,
that's right.
No affiliation with the band Pantera. Although you never know, maybe he was he might be the little brother of the lead singer of Pantera. If anyone is into their mid-2000s screamo emo bands or anything, it might be a little. Maybe they named themselves after. After this character, like, oh, we don't like the Pran, but we'll go for Pantera. Yeah, well, let's roll with that.
It's very possible. I'm not that much of a fan of theirs, so you would know better than me.
Oh no, I'm not a fan of theirs either. But some of my friends when I was a teenager were, so I had a lot of Pantera blasted at me over the years, begrudgingly, you know.
Okay, makes sense. So we ended things yesterday with the FBI chief Pantera saying the name Gruber mean anything to you, Lieutenant?
Mm.
And then John looks at him and goes, rings a bell. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that I didn't mention yesterday, we were talking about the actor who plays the FBI director. So as you mentioned yesterday, his name is Richard Russell Ramos. He was born in 1941 and passed away in 2006. All right. Now, he only has 20 IMDb credits, and he is mostly known as a stage actor or a stage director. But the most fascinating thing that I found out about him, unfortunately, is that he actually died during a rehearsal for the play Amadeus. He was performing a rehearsal for the play Amadeus in Sarasota, Florida, at the Asilo Theater, and
was he playing Salieri, or is he just like a random part?
I wasn't able to find out who he played. It's very possible he played Salieri. I'm not sure, but during the rehearsal, he just dropped dead.
Oh wow! Holy moly!
Yeah.
You got to appreciate every moment, guys, because you might be. You could die mid Salieri if you're not careful, you know? It just hits people sometimes.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. So at this point, Walsh then says LA. Mm. And it's like then Walter looks at him and goes, "What?" And he goes, That thing in the building in LA.
Mm. But we
which is fun the way that they do this.
Yeah, I was wondering, like, they must have pored over this reveal because obviously that's coming straight after, too. The reveal of the name Gruber, McClane's reaction, then a little snippet.
That's right. We get like, a few seconds of Alan Rickman performing his last fall as Hans Gruber.
So it's also, like, why they chose that shot as well, of all the shots of Hans Gruber, where they're like, we have to show you the one where he's dying to emphasize that McClane killed him as well. Like to be.
Well, I think that's part of it, but I think it's also they want, this is theoretically John's memory. John's thinking back. So maybe John is going through his mind saying, wait a second, is it possible that Hans is still alive?
Oh.
So he's saying to himself, wait a second. I watched him fall off the 30th floor of the Nakatomi building. There's no way that he's still alive, but it could be that he's, reassuring himself that, okay, wait a second. It's not Hans who's right now enacting revenge against me. Yeah, it's someone else.
There'll be some note at the end that's like everyone just assumed. He was, oh, I guess he's dead over there. No one go claim that body.
And that's right.
He just got up and walked away.
Correct. I sure I hope that's not a hostage.
Yeah, that's a great moment. But like, I wonder too in editing though if they added. Is this in the script that this snippet happens, or
you're going to have to wait until the end of this minute to find out?
Because it feels like it could have been a thing like they poured over in editing, where they're just like, is it enough for people for that just have the name Gruber and then Ricky saying like, oh, the thing, and then the building, and like maybe they had test audiences who were like, I wasn't really too sure who Gruber, what that was about, whose brother he was. And they're like, well, in order to completely like solidify it in people's minds, we have to show a little glimpse of Alan Rickman, and it has to, and then whatever reason they just specifically chose this shot as well to be like the last time you saw him, I guess.
Right.
I do wonder if they had to, like, you know, if this was a result of like people not understanding what was going on and then having to like, we have to as economically as possible convey what the link is, without like John going into a soliloquy about like, yes, in 1988 in LA, I met Hans Gruber. He was played by Alan Rickman, and you know, all this kind of stuff. They just have to pour through it in as efficient a manner as they possibly can.
Right. It makes sense. I mean, I like the way that they do that, you know, to give us that little bit of a reminder. My assumption is, and I'm not looking at the script again right now to remember whether it's in there or not, but you know, I think that you've brought a good case for the fact that it probably came from, you know, a focus group that said, well, we don't know who this Gruber guy is. You know, can you remind us?
Or it's just like, or even to like people did know, but like Hollywood does treat people like children so much. So they might be like, we're worried that people might not know who it is. So therefore you have to do something.
Which sort of makes sense because they probably don't.
Although I was surprised here too, because I went to double check. I would have thought then this little snippet of Alan Rickman would have got him a credit in Die Hard with a Vengeance too, because like, you know, it would have been archival footage or whatever.
Right.
No, it's not on his IMDb list, and he didn't claim it back when he was alive, at least. It's
right. Unfortunately not claiming it now.
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. Very, so sad. So sad. What massive loss to the world Alan Rickman was. But
yes.
Yeah, it's just I would have thought, like, you know, you get some people will like grub up every credit they possibly can. So even though it's footage from a different film, they should technically be like, no, that's a credit to him. He did do that performance. It was in Die Hard with a Vengeance, you know, technically. But no, he didn't go for it.
Well, it reminds me of the whole lawsuit from Back to the Future.
Oh yeah,
you know, from Crispin Glover about whether you're allowed to use, you know, someone an image from a previous movie without crediting it.
I think you should credit it. To be fair, I think you should be like, no, that's, you know, it's still work. It's still this work. It's, you know, services rendered. So yeah,
right.
You know, you might have the rights to it, but you should always just give it a little like, well, in case anyone wants to know who was that guy falling off the building. Oh, I can look that up, and it was Alan Rickman. There you go.
Correct.
Yeah, there's so many little things like around. One I always bring up on Batman, because I always appreciate how devious it was, is in Batman and Robin when, you know, Mr. Freeze is conducting his goons.
Mm-hmm.
And they're singing like, I'm Mr. White Christmas. If you look at that, those guys aren't actually singing that. Their mouths are completely out of sync and they're not singing it at all. And apparently that is because they got around the fact that like, oh, if you have them speaking or singing, you have to bump them up from in extras, basically, and they have to get paid more. So what you do there, how you avoid that, is like you can keep them on the minimum rate as extras, is they just mouth the words. But if they sing that at all, then no, like you're gonna have to pay them more and stuff. I just always thought like, oh, my, you know, Joel Schumacher is such a nice man, but that's such a little devious way of saving a buck or two. It's just like, we ain't gonna pay these guys anything more than we have to. So
interesting.
That's such a
I've had that discussion before about like how does, and I don't know the answer to it, you know, like how does the pay scale rate work, you know, based on how many lines you have or whatever it is, you know, because sometimes you'll find people with you know with the credit in the credits and sometimes not.
Yeah.
You know, so
Yeah.
it's like, okay, what did they do to deserve that or not? You know, did they get paid more?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
I think you talking about things like at the end of, going back to Endgame, the end credits of Endgame literally credit nearly every actor who appeared in the freaking MCU.
Right.
Like, they go get a little thing, like people who aren't even in the film are popping up in it. Like, it's, or you might get like 2 seconds of Natalie Portman, probably from archival footage that they had a take. Like, just digitally insert Chris Hemsworth in the background there, and that's it. We just, we didn't have to approach Natalie for this at all. But yeah, she got a big like glory shot in the end of like when everyone else's faces were popping up. They pop in Natalie Portman too, and I don't know if she had to get paid for that or what. Maybe if she had a good agent, they would have been like, oh, I guess you have to throw her a couple of bucks, because even if she wasn't there to shoot, that's still technically using her image
Right.
for, yeah. So yeah, I don't know about I don't know if Alan Rickman would have pursued, legally, like I deserve money for this, showing this bit of footage of me, or if like he would have even seen Die Hard with a Vengeance. I don't know if it's his type of thing to be like, he'll appear in the things. I don't know if he would actually go out to the cinema to watch a Die Hard movie.
That's an interesting idea. You know, like we don't know what actors like watching movies and which ones don't. You know.
Yeah. I mean, I know, because Gary Oldman's on record as saying he doesn't like, he never watches his own films. He's like, oh no, I don't like doing that. I never watch any of my own stuff. And
Okay,
people got like offended
but this isn't
because they're
his
just
film.
like, yeah. But yeah, but the people are just sort of aghast of like, oh, how dare he not watch all these films he's in? It's like, it's his business. He can do what he wants. But yeah, then Alan Rickman been like, oh, would you like to go to the premiere of Die Hard with a Vengeance? Like, no, I don't think I would. No. But like, but yeah, you never know. Maybe he was a secret. Maybe he's a big action buff. He might have been. He was out there supporting Bruce in all his mid-90s endeavors.
Right. It's actually very funny. The actor who plays Walsh is the one who mentions LA, and
Yeah.
he's an actor who was also in the first Die Hard as, a different character. He was a young cop. It's funny that he's
I
the
guess
one who's
technically Mickey would have been
actually.
a young cop at that point as
Right.
well. Oh.
Correct. No, it's
But
just very funny that they do it that way.
yeah. No, like, maybe it was like a little joke on their part too. It was like, oh, you get the guy who was in the other movie to actually reveal the detail about the other movie. But yeah, but just wonder, like, like, is it a tale that McClane's told loads of times? Like, have they been out drinking at nights, and he'll go into like all the stuff that happened in Nakatomi,
Well,
or was it just such a thing that followed him? Like, McClane never talks about it, but like it's there. Like, people are like, oh, he was like, I remember that you saw on the news, right? All that stuff about the terrorists taking over Nakatomi Plaza and stuff like that. Like, I wonder like how much of it is that like they all know the legend of John McClane, or if it's more like a he talks about this all the goddamn time.
No,
Like, he never shuts up about
I
Alan.
think it's the legend because we know that in Die Hard 2, they talked about the fact that he was on Nightline and he was in People magazine and
Of course, of course, yeah.
So actually, I just found something very interesting about Alan Rickman. It says, according to Alan Rickman's diaries, he didn't want Hans Gruber regurgitated for this film, claiming they were cannibalizing his work and it was disgraceful.
Oh, wow.
He initially refused to allow the use of any stock footage until 20th Century Fox got their lawyers involved, and eventually Rickman agreed. So
Wow.
I'm
Holy
reading
moly.
between the lines there that he basically agreed because of the fact that they must have said, "All right, we'll give you $100,000 or whatever it is." And it's like, okay, well, if that's the case.
And also too, that he just didn't want the headache of just like, well, we've got like our fleet of lawyers here. Like, okay then. Like, he thought it would be as simple like, they'll just respect me if I say no. And they're like, oh no, and they're gonna make it a thing. Oh, okay. It's like getting a parking ticket. It's like, I'm not gonna pay this. Oh wait, no, I guess I better. Like,
Right, because if I don't
if I
pay it,
don't,
then the it's gonna double and triple and quadruple and all that stuff.
yeah, it's just like, well, I'm not paying this train fine. This is ridiculous. But like, if you try to contend, it's going to lead to this, and like, okay,
All right,
just go
I'll
ahead
do
and
it.
just
I'll
do
do
this.
it.
Yeah,
Exactly.
but no, that's all. Yeah, I wouldn't have thought his reaction would have been that volatile, though. The cannibalizing his work, like, so is that implying that he was like outraged at the idea of even Simon Gruber being a character, like, oh, linking back to Hans, or is it just specifically he didn't want anything to do with showing old footage of him?
It sounds to me that it is.
Oh, wow. It's yeah. Who thought he would have had such a passionate reaction to that?
Yeah, apparently. Yeah. Interesting.
I think they do now because he's involved in Harry Potter and stuff. It's like, you know, whatever they do with that franchise, they'll use old footage of Alan Rickman for whatever the hell they want. You know, that's just in perpetuity forever. It's like, oh, Snape's going to pop up on lunchboxes and on this, that, and the other for the remainder of time, probably. I'm sure if he were alive today, he might be still outraged by the fact that he's part of a franchise that will continue to cannibalize his work.
Correct.
Because until it becomes unprofitable.
Right. Yeah, I don't think Harry Potter is going to stop being profitable at any point in their future. Yeah, it's just...
Well, I think now maybe Harry Potter, because they're doing that TV version of it now.
Right.
I think they'll probably try to shift everything over to it being like, no, Snape is now, you know, Oscar Isaac or whoever. And then that's going to be that'll be your Snape for the remainder of time. But
what do you mean? It's going to be Pablo Fisco.
Pedro Pascal. Get that guy into everybody. We can't fail with him. Everybody loves him.
Sorry. So, I mean, John mentions the term. He says it rings a bell. Do you know, first of all, what that term means and where it comes from?
Well, I know what it means. I wouldn't be able to tell you the etymology. Like, I don't know if it's – I would have assumed it has something to do with, like, church bells or just like a little – or – like remind, like alarm clock bells, maybe to like, you know, a thing to remind you to wake up, you need a bell. So it's ringing a bell to be like, oh yeah, I need to, you know, but I don't know.
Sorry, that's not what it is. First of all, the phrase means that it's something that sounds familiar. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the term became popular because it's connected to Pavlovian origins.
Oh, No. Now that makes sense. Actually, no. I can see where you're going with this.
That's right. Because Pavlov did a whole bunch of experiments using bells in order to invoke memory of past events, such as providing food and stuff like that.
Yeah. That makes that 100% makes sense. I don't know why I didn't think of that person.
Right. To be honest with you. Okay. It's fine. The phrase goes back to the 1930s, basically. So
yeah, I wonder what they would have said before that. There was another term that everyone's now forgotten.
Oh, I remember that.
When you yeah. Does it ring a bell?
Exactly. And then they continue by explaining. They said Peter Krieg was born Simon Peter Gruber. He's Hans Gruber's brother. And then John goes on.
He's really getting to like chew on this dialogue, this guy.
That's right.
Because you know, it's the tone of voice, but it's a beautiful delivery. Like he was born Simon Peter Gruber. He's Hans Gruber's little brother. It's like he's almost like telling him quite smugly. Like he's almost got like a little smile on his face as he's telling him, like, "That's right, I get to be the one to tell you, McLean, that this time it's personal." It's like, I don't need to take such pleasure in it, man. Come on. Like, it's still a problem for everybody, right?
Yeah, seriously. And, I mean, what's great about it is that the way he just – this is all he does in this movie. This is his line. He's given the Hans Gruber information, and that's it. And John yeah.
– He doesn't even get mentioned by Simon either. Like when he's being Simon, doesn't know who
that's
he is.
Right.
He's like, oh, and of course, a cool looking FBI guy in glasses in the back there. I'm not familiar with him.
That's right. And then Cross goes, yeah, it's that thing in LA. We figure he's gotten fitted for a toe tag, and he's gonna do anything to get it tied.
That's just such action movie dialogue. like people don't talk like
people
that.
Definitely do not talk that way. And then,
yeah, but yeah, it's a good line though.
That's right.
Yeah, it's badass cop stuff.
That's right. And I love that when he's delivering this line, he takes his glasses off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just okay, this is the way it is. And then, they get interrupted.
You know, personal connection, you know.
And then they get interrupted by Officer Jane again, who says, Inspector, it's him. Now it's really funny because like here she's holding a cell phone. So apparently Simon has Cobb's cell phone. You know,
Yeah.
As opposed to beforehand, you know, we never saw a point where Cobb said, okay, well, if you want to get back to me, dial, you know, 201-555, whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, if Simon, did he hack a system?
That's right. That, like, how did he get that number?
Like,
but they got the number.
Yeah.
And they give him the cell phone, and it's a very good thing that they have a universal cell phone, because they're able to hook it up, you know, within the van so that everyone can hear. You know, because nowadays it'd be like, okay, which is that, USB 2 or USB 3? You know, is that you know, is that from an Apple, or is that you know,
This would be like I never understand this. Charlie,
that's
come
right
in here. It's just like, oh. Yeah, just have to sit there for ages, Simon up on the rooftop, like, oh man. It's like, we've not got time for this, you know. I needed to make this quick phone call before I get the
dust right over here. And then
they're holding up everything.
And then you know, they say to him, they say, don't let them know we're here. Yeah, right. And then then Cobb picks up the phone and goes, Simon. He goes, Inspector. Now, yeah, from the FBI is in the van? I wonder. Let's see. Almost certainly Cross. Come on, Andrew. Say hello. Hello. Now, how does he know that Cross is the one who's going to be in there?
Well, that's the thing I was wondering, if it's that the implication here is, and we got to do it more next minute, too, when he's specifically saying what Bill is doing. If it's supposed to be that, like, he is now currently watching them right now, he's got whatever angle he's able to see into the van or whatever, or is it just more that he's just that?
I think they're trying to show his intelligence.
You'd be like, oh, at this point he would know, like, of course they're going to be there, and of course these would be the guys I send. And what does Bill do all the time? Because I've been telling him, and I know these guys. He would be chewing his glasses and stuff. But yeah, so I was never too sure if it was that he was literally like, because they don't freak out enough to be like, oh, he's watching us right now, like. He can literally see us at this exact second. You think they'd be all pouring out of the van or like trying to signal someone, like, go look on the rooftop.
Well, what gets me even more is the fact that you know, if Cross and Jarvis know Gruber so well, then they really are holding back a lot of information.
Yeah. Because there's almost a vibe, like, again, we don't want to get into, you know, the comments about Bill next minute too much, but like, the kind of way he has a little, they both have a little side, like, oh, of course he knew about this, as if, like, we've dealt with this guy before, like, we've had interactions with him, so, like, we have personally spoken to Simon Gruber before, because, so, yeah, of course he would know that about us, and this is exasperating, having to deal with this dude again, kind of thing. This is sort of a general question, but now that Simon's on the phone and we get to, like, to talk about the Simon of it all. Did you bring up, though, had they ever really acknowledged in, like, the making of stuff, like, the entire principle of Simon on the phone and getting McClane to run around New York is directly taken from the first Dirty Harry movie?
I don't recall Scorpio hearing that, but it's very possible.
Oh, no, I think I've always felt it as if, like, I would never say anything bad about Die Hard with a Vengeance, but they 100% ripped that off from Dirty Harry. Like, there's a whole section in the middle where the Scorpio Killer's got a girl buried, and he's just like, and then in order for Harry to find her, he is literally making him run from payphone to payphone, or otherwise I'm going to do this. And it's exactly like the opening, like, 40 minutes of Die Hard with a Vengeance. So it's one of those things I wonder if they, I very, like, because it's only like a little 10-minute sequence in Dirty Harry. But I wonder if, like, the screenwriters saw that and were like, you can make a whole movie of that. Like, that's great stuff. Like, why aren't people doing
what I understand, like, the idea for the movie came when Jonathan Hensley was thinking about, like, some things that happened to him when he was a kid, and, like, what would happen if someone came back and wanted to, you know, revenge.
Yeah. But now there's just that action, though, of making a cop run from phone call to phone call, otherwise I'm going to do a thing. It's just like, it's so similar. I always took it as like, no, they just took it from Dirty Harry. And then, to be fair, though, you know, and people who listen to Batman will know, Chris Nolan is a guy who swipes a lot of stuff. Like, you know, he's obviously a genius in his own way, but he does take a lot from a lot of other films. As do many filmmakers, to be fair. Like, you know, there's so many homages, and, you know, how do you come up with these ideas? You just take them from something else. But so much of The Dark Knight, too, really reminds me of Die Hard with a Vengeance, because it's essentially the Joker is kind of like Simon, just going like, if you don't do this, if you don't go to this spot and do what I want you to do, then I'm going to blow up a place. You know, the whole sequence with the hospital near the end of the film is just like, it's Die Hard with a Vengeance on a mass scale, almost, of just like, yeah, I don't want that guy revealing who Batman is. It's going to ruin my fun. Everybody go kill him. Otherwise, I'm going to blow up a hospital. And it's just like, it's just an extrapolation of like, well, that's Simon.
Right.
Die Hard is like, if you don't do this thing. Yeah. So it's I'm going to specifically blow up a place. And it's just that kind of omnipresent, you know, malignant genius of like being able to anticipate things and all that kind of thing. I always took it like, we haven't gotten into it on the show yet, but I've always took it to be Chris Nolan took Simon from Die Hard and the villain from the Japanese film Cure and just mashed that together and was like, that's my Joker, you know?
Oh, wow.
But anyway, that's all Batman stuff. That's
very cool. I like that idea.
When we get to the Nolan stuff, Rob, we'll have you on. You can bring back up your Die Hard notes to talk about.
Sounds like fun. So the only thing I could find right now about the connection between Dirty Harry and this movie is that it's actually mentioned twice in the IMDb trivia that the kids who are trapped in Dirty Harry, they sing "Row, Row, Row Your Boat," and the kids in this movie, when they're in the school, they're singing also "Row, Row, Row Your Boat."
No, let them be so much a swipe as an homage. Correct. Then
they're like, they knew what they were doing.
Yeah, that's a great moment in Dirty Harry too. Is like, because it's Andy Robinson as Scorpio,
right? So. All right, I don't have anything else for this minute. Do you?
He's crying and stuff, and he's just shouting in their faces, like, come on, row, 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 your boat. Like, it's so like, dude, you are not getting away with this at all. Like, these kids are not having a good time.
Well, they're not supposed to be having a good time if they're being held hostage.
Well, I think, though, he's trying to make sure, like, he's kind of going, like, oh, we're going to the ice cream factory, kids, don't worry. He's trying to keep it, like, oh, everyone, it's all good. Which I think they get away with a bit more in Die Hard with a Vengeance, because that scene comes across as, like, the kids all probably know something really bad is happening, but they're really having to put on a smile and make sure everything's okay and stuff. And I always felt like, yeah, the two kids were just like, this is lame. Let's get out of here, because that'd be the same thing.
Let's go play cards. So.
Yeah.
All right.
You'll get there.
We shall get there. So I don't have anything else for this minute. Do you have anything else for this minute?
No, nothing for the beyond just to be like, oh, I'm just so happy I got some Simon on the phone, because this was this is always one of my things where, like, so I love this film and I've grown to love it even more over the years. I remember when I was a kid having like I kind of felt that they should have left Simon as a voice on the phone up until the very end, like it should have been literally when they were on like the boat.
You mean like what they did in Jaws?
Exactly that same principle. You don't reveal the guy until, you know, it's like the Wizard of Oz. You don't see Simon in his final form until the climax. So it should have been like, yeah, when Zeus meets him for the first time, because that's a big moment for Zeus. It's like, oh, this is the guy. That's when they would have revealed Simon. But now, because I think now I just grown to enjoy Jeremy Irons so much more. And I just love all the holy Galito, somebody had fun. And all like, now I'm like, oh no, you can't change a thing about this film. It's all that's perfect. Right. I take it all.
Yeah, you needed to have him there. All right, so we're back with the script, which we haven't talked about in a few days, but there is a lot from this minute in the script. So it starts off with Cross saying, Detective McLean, 4 years ago, the communist bloc's top field operative in East Germany was caught attempting to assassinate the leaders of the new democratic regime in Romania. He was sentenced to life imprisonment in Bucharest jail. 6 weeks ago, he escaped. We have positive confirmation. He's pierced United States soil. What's this got to do with me? I've never been to Germany, East or West, and it'd take me a minute to find Romania on a map. Cobb exchanged a look with Jarvis and Cross. Detective McLean, is the name Gruber familiar with you? A pause. McLean's eyes narrow. Yes. Jarvis flips open his briefcase and removes a CIA intelligence dossier. He closes the briefcase and shuts the dossier on his lap. It is stamped with the government seal, priority, top secret. Jarvis turns the dossier around and opens the cover. Close on McLean as he looks at the dossier, his jaw muscles tighten, his eyes darken. Hans Gruber, correct? Now we see, insert in the dossier is a photograph of Hans Gruber, played by Alan Rickman in Die Hard, standing in front of East Berlin's Brandenburg Gate, smiling, his arm around someone we cannot see because the other half of the photograph is obscured by a piece of paper. 5 years ago, Hans Gruber tried to steal $600 million in bearer bonds from the Nakatomi Exchange in Los Angeles. You thwarted the theft and killed him. Did you know that Gruber was a member of East Germany's counterintelligence community? Did you know, Detective McLean, that he had a brother, a younger brother named... He removes a sheet of paper from the photograph. Insert the dossier photograph. Hans Gruber's arm is around a younger man, also smiling. A younger and more sinister version of Hans. Simon. McLean stares at Simon Gruber, the brother of the man he killed. His mind is racing. He swallows hard. Tell me about this guy. Jarvis flips through the dossier. He reads Simon Gruber's intelligence report as McLean flips through more photographs. Simon Gruber, born February 13, 1952 in Dresden, conscripted in the East German Army 1970. A picture of Simon Gruber in a military uniform. Court-martialed 1972 for assaulting a superior officer. He was offered the firing squad or service in their secret police. Suffice to say, he took the latter. Photographs of Simon Gruber exiting an automobile in Paris. What was his job? Assassin, and a very good one. In 1976, he neutralized our best agent. Gruber has an IQ of 187. He's fluent in 17 languages and impossible to contain. He comes and goes as he wishes. Simon Gruber, pictures of Simon Gruber on a bridge over the Danube in Vienna. Simon Gruber moving through a crowded street in Budapest. He's clinically psychotic. In 1980, the Israelis tried to take him out. The agent missed, but killed Gruber's lover. Simon Gruber, with a beautiful young woman in a cafe in Amsterdam, is shown in a photograph. Jarvis then says, 2 weeks later, the Israeli agent, most of him, was found in a hotel closet in Prague. Most of him? His head was placed neatly in the middle of the bed, on a pillow. Ah, fuck me. Zeus rises up. This has been fun, fellas, but I think I hear my mother calling. Jarviston, sit down, Mr. Carver. Simon Gruber has come to New York, and he's not very happy with Detective McLean, or you, for that matter. Because of the use of explosives, we're inclined to think Simon's with this man. He shows a photograph of a dark, compact man on a street in Eastern Europe. Matthias Targo, Hungarian. Gruber's protege, easily the terrorist community's most dangerous explosives expert. There's a knock on the van door. Yes. The van door opens. Detective Ricky Walsh leans in the door with a grim expression, says to Cobb. Arthur, hands Cobb a cellular phone. It's him again. Everyone stares at the phone in Cobb's hand. Hello? Hello, Arthur. Cross turns to a young FBI agent in the back of the van. Tommy, speaker. Cobb then says, Simon, I'm putting you on speakerphone. Cobb hands the phone to the young FBI agent in the back of the van. He puts the cellular phone in a modem with a speaker capability. We hear Simon. Let's see. I bet there's John McLean and Zeus. And who from the FBI? A pause. Cross clears his throat. This is Deputy Director Andrew Cross, Simon. Deputy Director, I'm insulted. And who am I missing? So that's all we have for this. I mean, I think it's a little too comprehensive. I mean, it gives us a lot of information. I think it's great the way that it gives the information.
Yeah, I think that would have been like 2 or 3 minutes of the film.
Exactly.
I think they made a lot of right choices in cutting that way down.
I mean, I like the fact that he has Cross introduce himself. I think that works better in the script than it does in the movie, because in the movie it sounds like, okay, you know, they're just playing tag with one another always. At this point,
I would say the opposite. I like the fact that like they kind of have the moment of like, don't tell them that we're here, and it's just like, I know that you're there. Like it shows you that he's one step ahead of them. It kind of adds to how dangerous he is. He's just like, well, you know, I know you think that you're gonna outsmart me, but like, oh, don't tell them that I'm here. It's like, okay. Yeah, so Andrew,
all right,
Andrew,
also there. I can see both sides. All right, I definitely can.
Yeah. I like that. You know, it's good they have some little bits of like more backstory, like, you know, the killing the guy and putting his head on the bed and stuff like that. And then, like, all the stuff, like, oh, Simon and the woman he loves.
And I love the fact that they have...
But it's bordering into cheesy.
I love the fact that they have Zeus say, all right, I'm out of here.
Yeah, yeah. No, I can't do it very relatable because it would be like, okay, I didn't realize this is like, this guy sounds like a proper nut job and I don't want anything to do with this anymore. I didn't want anything to do with it at the beginning.
That's exactly.
Yeah, and also, too, they might have had to get around because I guess that probably saved them a couple of bucks. So, like, so we need to get Alan Rickman in to, like, pose for a photo and stuff. And, like, we got to pay him for that, right? And then, yeah. So, yeah, I think, yeah, cutting it way, way down, they made a lot of right choices. And just make this compact and make it as clear as possible. And, like, and literally all you need is, like, a little blip of him. And go, like, in case you didn't know who it was, it's that guy from the... It's that guy from the first movie.
All right. So every Thursday we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track Revenge Sibling Rivalry Edition, where my guest will give some sort of story, anecdote, adventure, misadventure, something that's happened to them over the course of their life that is somehow related to revenge.
I feel really bad, Rob, because you asked it. And it's the same thing that happened during the It's a Wonderful Life season. You asked a question. I was like, I don't have anything for you, man. Like, I have two brothers, but they're both so much older than me that, like, I don't have any, like, rivalry with them because I barely saw them when I was a kid. They were out of the house and stuff. So it wasn't very close.
Well, it doesn't have to be with a brother. It could be with anybody, some sort of revenge story that you know. Where you played a prank on somebody or someone played a prank on you.
No, I don't think, no, I don't, I'm a lover, not a fighter, Rob. I don't go seeking revenge on people. No, the only thing I was trying to think of, like, the only stories I could think of had nothing to do with me. Because the only story that popped in mind is so far in the other direction of not being a rivalry was, my friend Lauren, when her parents got, like, you know, they got divorced and then they got remarried. I remember her very proudly telling me, like, the day she met her new stepbrother, they just went and had sex in the back of the kitchen. And it was just one of these things of, like, oh, yeah, we were crazy kids. Oh, that was a time. And I was like, oh, that's a bit messed up. Like, but I guess this was before your parents, they got married, so he wasn't your brother at that point. And she's like, oh, no, we did it after, too. Like, we kept doing it for a while. And it's like, I don't know why it turned into, like, sibling rivalry stories. I was like, the only one I could think of. It was my friend who kept bragging, like, oh, yeah, me and my stepbrother used to just, like, hook up and do stuff we shouldn't have been doing because we were supposed to be brother and sister at that point. But no, in terms of rivalry, I got nothing for you, man. I'm sorry. I don't, I try to avoid conflict in my life. So I haven't gone after on it with a vengeance.
All right, that's fair. That's fair. I just wanted to point out one thing from the script, which you might not have noticed, that there's the discrepancy in the script between Arthur and Walter. It's the same character. You know, what's really funny is that in the movie and in IMDb, he is credited as Arthur, but everyone calls him Walter in the movie. But in the script, he's also Arthur.
Wow. So.
Yeah.
Weird. I wonder why the change. Why would they just, like, after a while, like, he feels more like a Walter to me.
Like, all right, Niall, would you like to once again tell people where they can find Niall McGowan?
I'll plug today my side show, which just finished up quite recently, was Miami Minutes, which is a podcast where we broke down and talked about every minute of the 1980s Kung Fu ninja biker nutsoid classic Miami Connection, which just has its own history and lore unto itself, but we did that 1 minute at a time, unlike Batman, because Batman's a bit more comprehensive and we get in guests and there's a lot of research involved and stuff. Try to make it, you know, entertaining but also educational. Miami Minutes is just me and my friend John riffing on a ridiculous film, because there was no research to do because none of the people involved went on to do anything else. It was that big of a bomb when it came out. But we had a lot of fun. We really got into, like, we created our own universe in that podcast to explain everyone's backstories and stuff. And we walked away from it going, like, I might actually write a spec novelization of Miami Connection now, because we did so much material trying to explain the universe and stuff that I think that could be what makes my fortune down the line. It's like, yeah, we end up writing the novelization of a forgotten 80s kung fu movie that that nobody asked for. But yes, that's all available at Miami Minutes, and it's at every single podcatcher that you can think of. We're on Spotify and everything. So
all right. There you go. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. You can also find me on Instagram. Or if you want to send me an email, send it to moviearoundminute@moviearound.net. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.
He comes marching home again. Hoorah, hoorah. We'll give him a hearty welcome then. Hoorah, hoorah. The men will cheer, the boys will shout, the ladies, they will all turn out, and we'll all feel glad when Johnny comes marching home.